You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of April 2016 on Monocle 24. What's the next move for Dilma in Brazil? Why is China now talking out about Trump? And are cinema-goers ready for a film that lasts 720 hours? I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is Midori House. On the programme today, as President Dilma Rousseff loses more friends in the Brazilian parliament, we'll ask what's next for the nation's leader, who now faces a lengthy impeachment battle. My guests Kathleen Burke and Alistair Bunkle will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, from Iraqi warfare to Swedish cinema. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, in the next 30 minutes. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Alistair Bunkle, Defence Correspondent for Sky News. Welcome both to the programme. We begin in Brazil, where the country's president, Dilma Rousseff, is in the midst of a huge battle to keep her job. Last night, the country's parliament voted to begin the impeachment process, which could see her expelled from office. The yes voters in Brazil's lower house easily won two-thirds of the votes needed to press ahead, and the motion is now in the hands of the upper house, Brazil's Senate. But the politics behind the impeachment process is complicated. She's accused of cooking the books ahead of the 2014 election, but she wouldn't be the first Brazilian president to do that. Her Workers' Party, or PT, has been embroiled in a massive corruption scandal, but so far, Dilma herself hasn't been accused of wrongdoing. So, Kathy Burke, what's really going on here?
Well, what's really going on, as far as any foreigner can tell, is that there's a huge reaction by the center and the right against the so-called Workers' Party, which has been in power for 12 years, has made a great number of changes, which including lifting 26 million people out of poverty. But as you said, embroiled in the great Petrobras scandal, although having said that, so has a good part of the entire political class of all political persuasions. It's difficult, you know, because the Workers' Party made Brazil a finer, nicer place to live for a substantial proportion of the population. One can only think that perhaps that if you knock out the Workers' Party, the politicians who are in power will remain there, and if they're in power, they have some immunity from actually going to jail for any of the sorts of things they may have done.
Alistair Bunker, when we look at some of the figures involved in taking on Dilma Rousseff, who are leading the impeachment charge, there's the Vice President, Michel Temer, who will take over if Dilma Rousseff is forced to step aside. He's accused of involvement in an illegal ethanol purchasing scheme. Eduardo Cunha, he's the Speaker of the Lower House, he's leading the whole effort. He's going to be going on trial soon on charges that he pocketed as much as $40 million in bribes. There's a bigger issue here as well, isn't there, in Brazilian politics?
I think of about 594 elected politicians in the Brazilian Congress, more than 350 of them face accusations of criminality. So
That's a high ratio.
That is a very high ratio. And we are very quick to judge our politicians here in this country. But perhaps we should take stock when you look at those numbers. And I would suggest that there probably is no smoke without fire with some of them. So Dilma Rousseff is by no means the only politician who is facing some sort of scandal in her own political life. And it does point to, as you say, a far wider and deeper problem within Brazilian politics. The idea of corruption, the idea that people have been brought into politics in order to safeguard them against any criminal proceedings, which is one of the accusations being levelled against Dilma Rousseff for bringing her own former president at Petrobras in order to make him a member of the cabinet and therefore immune from any criminal prosecutions. Some who, and they are few, who defend Dilma Rousseff, I mean, her poll ratings are terrible. I think about 10% of the country think that she's doing a good job.
And that's higher than it was a few months ago, where it was down to 7%.
Yeah, I think, and well over 50% think that she should go. Some of those very few supporters will say actually she has led a fairly sort of corrupt-free presidency, but I think their voices are very small right now.
Cathy, you know, one of the problems that Brazil has is that it is still a young democracy. It's a young democracy that also had a military dictatorship for a good number of years and only really returned to democracy in the late 80s. Are we, in a sense, expecting too much of this democracy?
You mean that it should be clean and squeaky clean?
Well, no, just that it takes a long time.
Well, of course it takes
a long time for a democracy to be embedded and to work properly.
Yes, that's very true. And democracy as such was working quite well, in the sense that the people felt that they had a say in it. And one problem right now is that a substantial portion of the people who voted for the Working Party think that their votes are being nullified, that there's, in a sense, a coup, an outward non-military political coup against the woman who won the election. She didn't win it by very much, but she won it. And it's corruption is the real difficulty, isn't it? It means that huge numbers of the political class and the business class have a stake in getting rid of her. And what's really odd, as has been quite clear, which everyone has pointed out, is that she's the one person who is not really charged with corruption. So the one person who is relatively squeaky clean is trying to be thrown out by all the thieves, one might say.
There's also, Alistair, been a sort of an interesting sort of dichotomy over the past few years in that, yes, there have been lots of corruption scandals in Brazil over the last few years, but unlike previously, many people have been prosecuted.
Yes, that's true. But I think they see with Dilma Rousseff and what they would classify as for her cronies coming into her inner circle as that probably coming to a halt. I mean, I think I'll just pick up from what Cathy was saying. I think one of her problems is she's not as popular as her predecessor was and hasn't followed that on, which is why, I mean, she's not even, halfway through her term in office. And I don't know whether you know better than I do about having a female leader of the country and how that has sort of reacted within the wider population, within the wider electorate, or whether that in itself is a problem.
If it's a problem, they're not saying it, which she isn't being accused. And after all, with Cristina Kirchner next door almost, you can hardly say that a woman can't sort of lead a country.
But, I mean, there is an argument, isn't there, Cathy, that, as Asa says, Lula da Silva was incredibly charismatic and carried lots of people who weren't perhaps the natural constituency for the Workers' Party, whereas Dilma Rousseff was the slightly stiff chief of staff who was sort of, remember when she first ran for office as president, she had Lula alongside her every single rally. He would sort of pep them all up and then she'd come along and speak rather woodenly. She's needed him all the way through, hasn't she?
So what else is new about many political leaders around the world? One can think of a number of them. It would be entirely the case. But she won. She won. There's no getting around that. And Lula didn't actually move next door as though it was Prince Albert, the consort to the Queen. He did not make a lot of obvious political moves. So in that sense, obviously he was there and he probably advised her. He must do. And he was a close friend and she was his protege and so forth. But no one has really accused her of being or rather like in Burma at this point, in Myanmar. No one has really accused her of being nothing but a front woman for Lula.
Alistair, part of the problem we face with this is that it is essentially a zero-sum game. It's one side has to win. Because Dilma Rousseff's running mate in the last election was someone from another political party, it was a coalition, and that gentleman, Michel Temer, is certainly no ally of Dilma Rousseff now. There is this problem that if you voted for Dilma Rousseff first time round, if you voted for the PT, the Workers' Party, you're not going to be happy with the second choice who's going to take over.
No, neither is he a spring chicken either. 75 years old. So he's a very different prospect. He comes from an academic background as opposed to a business background, like Dilma Rousseff, having been the chairwoman of Petrobras. And yeah, he is the minority holding in a coalition, effectively, in that regard. And so it is a different prospect for the country. I think that if Congress decides to have these impeachment proceedings, he probably would take over temporarily or in the interim period. But those proceedings could last many, many, many months. And we stretch well into the summer, and we then stretch into the Olympic Games. And what might that mean for the sort of feeling of the country?
Whether there's a feel-good factor that comes in because of that. Which head of state is going to be opening the Olympic Games?
Well, exactly. It raises all sorts of questions.
This isn't necessarily possible under the Brazilian constitution as it stands, or some would have to sort of push this forward. But, Cathy, in a sense, is the cleanest way out of this fresh elections?
Well, that's unconstitutional at this point. They have fixed election terms, so that would require quite a fundamental political change. So no, it'd be very difficult, in fact, and that would be an upheaval all of its very own. I suspect, as Alistair said, we have 7 months ahead of us. They've got 1 month for the Senate to decide whether they're going to go ahead and impeach. This is probably a dead. Then they've got 180 days. For the committees to discuss, and then they must have a plenary session headed by the Chief Justice, and then they vote. And they need a two-thirds vote in that. So the actual conviction is much less likely than the actual, setting for trial and that were. But it's quite right. It wanders into the Olympic time, and they're not ready for that at all. They've got about one, the aquatic area is finished, and that's about it. And we can't forget the Zika virus as well. That could easily come back.
Alistair, just to return to the Olympics for a moment, what does it mean for Brazil's image around the world if actually, as we lead up to the Olympic Games, it appears as if this country is mired in chaos?
Personally, I don't think it matters hugely. I think the only thing that matters is that the Games are a success. They look good aesthetically. They pass without security incident. Because don't forget, the lead up to the World Cup, we were very worried about possible security incidents, and the same applies this time around 2 years later. And they must be good sport, if you like. And I think if all of those things come off in the way that the London 2012 Olympics did, I don't think actually anyone will pay a huge amount of attention to the political wranglings internally in Brazil.
Do you agree with that, Kathleen?
I agree entirely. And I also agree that I also think that at the end of the day, we're not going to have a huge political turmoil at the end of the next 7 months. And then we know what spectacle the Brazilians can provide. I think everyone will have quite a good time.
Okay. Let's turn now to Iraq. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter is in Baghdad today to discuss how to strengthen the Iraqi security forces, who are looking to recapture the city of Mosul in the north of the country from IS. Throughout the battle with ISIS, the fight is fought on many fronts. One area where the outfit has been looking decidedly shaky in recent months is allegedly its finances. Recent figures claim income for the group has dropped by around a third since the middle of the year. Damage done to ISIS-controlled oil facilities by Western airstrikes, loss of territory, and of course, low oil prices are the main contributors. Alistair Bunker, when we look at the fight against ISIS, it's often described as a military fight, but there are many other factors involved, aren't there?
Yeah, very much. It's very much an asymmetric battle, and a lot of that, as you've just described, is defeating Islamic State financially, economically, and the economic apparatus that it has built up around itself, which these figures would suggest is being relatively successful. Now, there are reasons for these figures. They're not necessarily wholly solid. So take oil production, for example, one great source of revenue for Islamic State. That has been cut quite considerably. Now, that is partly, in large part, down to coalition airstrikes targeting the major oil fields, particularly in the east of the country, a place like Deir ez-Zor. Both the British, the Americans, and others have been targeting those very, very heavily. But Islamic State shows quite a proficient capability of rebuilding itself and has the ability to still keep production going despite being hit time and time again. So whilst this is progress, I don't think it is finite.
Cathy, it's also, often when the fight against ISIS is talked about, we talk about the numbers of troops that everyone has. But when you look at the battle that is, likely to be fought for Mosul, recently the Iraqi army thought they'd made some progress. 10,000 troops had helped sort of retake some villages. They were, heading towards Mosul. They were pushed back by just 200 ISIS fighters.
Yes. A bit sad. I mean, there are problems. One problem, of course, is being able to see what's going on. And although there are Apache helicopters in the country, the Iraqis have said they don't want them utilized as much as the Americans would like them to. It's a question of élan, I suppose one might say, that the Iraqi army doesn't seem, and Alistair will know more about this than I do, I suspect, does not seem to have, it's not the will to win, but the belief that they can do so. In fact, and how many of them, again, Alistair may have numbers, how many of them are actually ghost soldiers as they used to be, on the roster but not actually there? The question of intelligence, they need that. I think that they are on a forward roll. But I think also without a bit more help from the Americans, who are rather anxious to give it to them, it's going to be very difficult the closer they get to Mosul, if only because of all the IEDs that are sitting, that are buried in the ground. They're going to die as they move closer towards the city.
And as Michael, this is still essentially the same army which ran away from Mosul just over 18 months ago when ISIS swept in.
Pretty much. I mean, a slightly polished version of it down to coalition efforts to train them. But yeah, pretty much the same thing. I would agree with Cathy's assessment. That is why we've seen the Defense Secretary, the US Defense Secretary, announce 200 more troops to US troops to Iraq, taking the number to about 4,000, and the deployment of more American Apache helicopters. So that is all about the fight for Mosul. And that is going to be the defining part of this war in Iraq.
Not you think overall.
So? Yeah, I think if and when, and I think it is a when, they retake Mosul, I think that is...
Why do you think it's a when?
Well, I think eventually the might of the coalition will win out. America cannot afford to allow Islamic State to retain power in Mosul ad infinitum. At some point, Mosul now resembles Islamic State's big footprint in Iraq. Just push Syria to one side for the moment. But in Iraq, that is the big stronghold of Islamic State. At some point, and that is resemblant in the announcement by Ash Carter today about sending more troops and Apaches there in order, and in his words, in order to assist the fight to retake Mosul. It is symbolic. It is a major city. But boy, will it be very, very difficult. I mean, you mentioned IEDs. It will be street-to-street fighting. It will be tunnels dug under the city in the way that it was Fallujah all those years ago when US troops went in there. It will be a very, very difficult battle.
And even then, once it's won, we only have to think back at the pictures of Kobani after that was retaken, from ISIS. There was not much left of it.
No, quite. And I do say when, and I sound very confident when I say when, but I think if you look at the pattern across Syria and Iraq, it is a very slow campaign, but it is a campaign that I do sense is going in the direction of the coalition. And the difference between Iraq and Syria is Iraq at least has a central government that is functioning to one degree or another. Cathy laughs, but more so than the government in Damascus. And so I think if you coalesce around that, Mosul is that final piece in the jigsaw. And I think they'll get there eventually.
Cathy, you can, if you really, really wanted to, you could try to paint an optimistic picture of the fight against Islamic State and say, well, look, it's... they're being pushed back in Syria, they've lost Palmyra, they're going to lose some others, they're being pushed back in Iraq. But it seems wherever they're pushed back in one place, they'll pop up in somewhere else. And we only have to look at what's happening in Libya now, where they control rather a large strategic amount of territory around the old town of Sirte. This isn't a sort of a numbers game. You kill a number of these people, and then there are few of them. They pop up elsewhere.
Well, for the past 3 months, squads, one might say, or groups of ISIS fighters have been leaving Syria and Iraq to go to Libya. precisely for that. After all, Libya is very close to Europe, and if you want to get to Europe, it's a lot closer there than Iraq. Iraq is going to continue to rumble for quite a while, I think. Might take out Mosul, the capital, and the center of, in a sense, of the ISIS oil flows. But there are a lot of other places in Iraq they can tie down American troops, for example, that will keep Iraq bubbling. But it's what you have to say, Steve, is quite correct, I think, is that you push down a bubble at one side and it comes up someplace else. And it seems to be coming up in Libya right now.
Whack-a-mole was what the American president described it as, wasn't it?
Indeed. What did you say? Sorry, I missed
Whack-a-mole. Do you know the game Whack-a-mole?
Sadly,
you
no.
Hit it one area and it pops up in another hole elsewhere.
Oh, a whole simile. I didn't know that.
You can use it from now on. Alistair, when we talk about who's fighting ISIS, it's, you know, we often talk about the coalition.
Yeah.
But we're essentially talking about America with, well, if it's in Iraq, there's a little bit of help from the Brits. If it's in Syria, there's some help from these guys. If it's in Libya, well, maybe the Italians are going to get involved. Whether that's a good thing for people, we'll see. But it's a amorphous coalition, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, look, if it's in Libya, hey, the Americans don't really want to get involved that much. I mean, they do tend to see Libya as a European problem and one that the Europeans should sort out themselves. And the reason that Italy takes the lead is for historical reasons in the country. I mean, I think you might see American involvement or at least of American lead on things like airstrikes, but airstrikes will be quite limited. The problem with someone like Sirte, where Islamic State are holed up in Libya, is, again, it is an urban area, so airstrikes can only be effective to a certain degree. So, yes, we are looking in Libya at much more of a European project. In Iraq and to some extent, really, Syria, it is an American, it's very much an American-led project with Britain and France and some others backing them up. But when you look at the contribution that America makes, it probably, well, it outweighs what all the rest make as a collective.
Okay, we'll leave it there just for now. You're listening to Midori House here on Molecule 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. When we come back, why even China is now talking about Donald Trump.
How do you write a biography? Are we all curators today? Who still makes fanzines? And how close are fact and fiction? These are some of the questions constantly puzzling us here at Monocle. So each week on our culture show, we spin the globe to find the very best writers, musicians, artists, gallerists, filmmakers, commentators, and even mudlarks to debunk these cultural mysteries. Tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, every Monday at 1900 UK time, where all will be revealed.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Kathleen Burke and Alistair Bunkle. Tomorrow, New York will vote for its preferred Republican and Democratic candidates for the US presidential race. But one man has made his preference known already to New Yorkers, and that's China's finance minister, Lo Jiwei. He's not keen on Donald Trump, describing the Republican candidate in an interview with the Wall Street Journal as an irrational type. Jiwei also highlighted how dependent the US and Chinese economies are on one another. So what else might the Chinese have to teach the US about trade and perhaps even its politicians? Kathleen, in a moment we'll come on to whether any of these interventions from foreign politicians are ever helpful. But in a sense, he's quite right. Donald Trump is an irrational type, isn't he?
Having said that, one should not forget that Donald Trump has a fan club in China, in fact, who think he's just utterly wonderful. So it's not a unified.
He also makes all his clothes in China, despite the fact that he goes on about how you shouldn't outsource to China.
Yes, we wait for him to put 45% tax on his own imports. Oh, yes. It's quite interesting, you know, because Putin thinks Trump is wonderful. Theoretically, they quite admire each other. The Chinese are a more important adversary than Russia will ever be again for the United States. So it's important what they think of Trump. On one hand, if he is seen as irrational, Trump will provide one of the best defenses that a foreign leader can, which is to be unpredictable. As it's also one of the most dangerous things a foreign leader can be, is to be unpredictable. But I don't think that the Chinese leadership actually think Trump will be elected, or they wouldn't be quite so straightforward about what they say about him.
Alistair Bunkle, Donald Trump will quite like this criticism, won't he? Because in a sense, that's what he's trying to do. He's saying, look, we have been too predictable as a nation when it comes to foreign policy. We want everyone else to be a little bit scared about what we might do.
I'm not sure Donald Trump is particularly adverse to criticism for some of the comments he makes. He must be very used to that by now. And look, he has made China something of a signature of his campaign. Now, look, in pure economic terms, this idea of a 40% levy on imports from China is just utter nonsense. It's what you'd get in economic terms as a deadweight loss. So the money that you'd bring in from such a tax would be less than the money that you would lose probably from installing such a penalty. But this is politics. You know, he's playing to an internal audience. He's not really playing to the Chinese audience. They're not going to elect him. They're not going to nominate him as a presidential candidate, and they're not going to put him in the White House. And the Chinese must know that a bit, whether or not they believe that he will get there or not. But Donald Trump is playing to his audience, and he has done so relatively successfully thus far, and he seems to be continuing along that vein.
Cathy, do voters ever care what politicians or leaders from other countries say about them or think about them? You know, here in the UK, we've got the EU referendum vote coming up in a couple of months' time. Hopefully then it'll all be over. We've had recently Emmanuel Macron, the French economy minister, saying, look, you guys are going to get killed in trade negotiations if you leave. President Obama is going to be here very soon, and he's going to say a few words about why he'd prefer Britain to stay. But voters don't tend to listen to foreign politicians, do they?
Well, Mr. Cameron seems to think that they will listen to President Obama, that somehow this will help the Remain group. So someone at least hopes desperately, if not believes, that this will actually be the case. Well, they think they'll take account of it if the foreign leader is going to say what the particular politician wants to hear. And there's always the chance that the odd few, certainly there's a better chance that many will listen to President Obama than they'll listen to the French finance minister.
Are you saying we don't like the French?
Oh, surely not. Wogs did begin at Calais, remember?
We'll move on from the French. We're going to finish with a bit of film chat. The new trailer from Swedish artist and filmmaker Anders Weberg for his upcoming film Ambiance is out. He might not be hoping to smash box office records, though. He describes it as an abstract, non-linear narrative summary of the artist's time spent with the moving image. But one area in which the film promises to break new ground is its length. When it's released in 2020, a full screening of Ambiance will last around 30 days. And the trailer, which came out today, clocks in at a sprightly 7 hours. Alistair, you've obviously spent all day today watching all 7 hours, so you could give us a little précis of it now in the sort of 90 seconds we have left. What did you make of it?
I watched about 7 minutes, not 7 hours.
Okay, well, that's not bad.
It is very slow, so I don't know whether he's stretching it out. It is not a movie. I think it's sort of conceptual art. It is good for publicity. He has made something like, and I wrote it down, 300 short films in his 20-year career, which he's coming to the end of his career, and he's decided to make the longest film ever. It's not for me.
Okay, so you're not going to be camping out at your local Odeon to
watch every single minute of it when it's released in 2020. In one go, you'd have to sit in the cinema and not go to sleep for 30 days.
Yeah, it's the not going to sleep as well. So I guess in a sense, it's longer than 30 days. Cathy Berg, I mean, it's art, not a film, isn't it? It's not the sort of thing that they'll be will be setting box office records.
Probably not, but it should be an insomniac's delight, I should have thought. This may be the one chance that people have got to fall asleep.
Not just a delight for an insomniac, delight for whoever's cast in the lead role, because that's a job for many, many years, I think, if you've got yourself a part in that film.
That's a brilliant comment, I think.
Okay, well, we might as well leave it on that. Kathleen Burke and Alistair Bunkle, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's programme. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Charlie Young. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. A bit of music next, and then, as you're hearing just before, it's Culture with Robert Bowne. around at 1900. Do stay tuned for that. He'll also have some highlights in that show from the Quality of Life Conference in Vienna this past weekend. More of the day's top stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200, including more live reaction from Brazil on the latest in the impeachment crisis. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 in London. That's 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening.